This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening around the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervy, and I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, right here in the studios of 790 KABC, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And I'm here solo once again because my co-host, the lovely and talented Carrie Kasem, is in Arkansas. She testified this week at the Capitol in Arkansas regarding her bill to help children see their ailing parents when they are blocked by someone who apparently doesn't like them that much. And that was the case of her father, Carrie Kasem. And Carrie Kasem, Casey Kasem. Carrie is so upset that she's not here today. She just texted me because we're going to talk about things that are near and dear to her heart. Carrie is a huge, huge gun advocate. She has talked on the show many times. She debated Erwin Chemerinsky on guns. She has a gun in her room. She's always ready to use it. She feels that at 5'5 and beautiful, she needs a gun to protect her. And today, that is going to be one of the subjects that we're going to talk about, and Carrie will miss it, but we'll tell her about it. And one of her heroes is actually going to be our guest, and that is none other than the guru of gun litigation, Alan Gura. For those of you who don't know who Alan Gura is, and you should, he was the lead attorney in the District of Columbia versus Heller case in 2008, which is the landmark Supreme Court decision in which the Second Amendment was recognized as an individual right. It was the first major U.S. Supreme Court case about guns and gun rights to be considered since the late 1930s. And then, again, he went to the Supreme Court and argued the McDonald versus City of Chicago case, which applied the Second Amendment to the states via the 14th Amendment. He has noted, he has been noted as one of the top 100 attorneys, most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal. He is a young guy. In 2009, Legal Times named Gura on the list of 40 under 40 of Washington, D.C.'s rising legal stars. Later in the show, after we talk a bit to Alan, we're going to welcome Sanford Levinson to the show. Sanford Levinson is University of Texas Law School professor. He is a prolific writer. He has written a lot on the Second Amendment. He even called it an embarrassment, I think. We're going to find out from Sandy Levinson what he thinks about the Second Amendment. We're also going to talk about, of course, some of the issues of the day regarding the Trump presidencies. This past week, we saw Donald Trump appear at Congress and deliver a speech, which a lot of people have commented on through the week. We're going to talk about a lot of stuff that Donald Trump talked about with our guests, Alan Gura, Sanford Levinson. And maybe later we just might have a special guest appear to give an editorial. Kenneth Kokin, who was the producer of The Way of the Gun and The Usual Suspects, is here in studio, and he has a few words to say about this subject, guns and constitutional rights. Without further ado, I want to introduce to all of you Gervy's Law listeners, Alan Gura. Alan Gura, welcome to Gervy's Law.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, Alan. And I have to say it, I'd be remiss if I didn't start with this. Your name and my name sound so close. You're Alan Gura and I'm Alan Gervy. And when you Google Alan G-U-R, your name comes up first, and then my name, just as it should be. Alan, I got to ask you, though, because my name wasn't always Alan Gervie, and I don't know if your name was always Alan Gerb, but I'm going to tell you a little story, and you can tell me how you got your name, because our names are so close, and people, maybe they mistake them. Actually, they don't, but let me tell you the story. In the 30s, in 1938, my father wanted to go to medical school, and at the University of Manitoba, where we lived, I didn't live at the time, he did, there were quotas on Jews to get into medical school, and they only took 5 Jews at that time, and he wasn't one of them. He had to go into the pharmacy business as an apprentice, and he changed his name from Gervich to Gervie because he thought perhaps it sounded less Jewish. That was the reality of that of those times, which we're experiencing a little bit of today, now, with the anti-Semitism, vandalism, the threats. So, you know, sometimes years pass, but times don't necessarily change that much. What's the origin of your name, Alan Gura?
Well, the name hadn't changed. Gura is the name that the family's had. My ancestors, I guess, came from probably the same places that yours did. All of my grandparents left in a very timely fashion, the eastern part of Europe, earlier in the previous century. Gura is, I suppose, it's more of a Polish name. We are Jewish, but some non-Jewish people have that name as well. It's not a super common name over there. It's much less common over here in the United States. There was a pitcher for the Kansas City Royals, no relation, Mary Gura, a number of years ago. Now, and that's about it as far as the famous personalities.
So it's not a shortened version, Alan. It's actually what your family had. You in the Kansas City picture, although you probably had different heritages.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is what it is, and but you're right though. I mean, human nature, unfortunately, for better or worse, remains the same. And just as people are always going to excel and achieve and do spectacular things, they're also going to be in a world with a few billion people in it, a few evil people, and there will be problems, and that's why we have the inherent natural right of self-defense, and in our Constitution we have a provision that guarantees that we have the ability to defend ourselves. We have access to the means of self-defense, and I believe very strongly about that. And of course, my beliefs in this area are reinforced by our family history.
Now,
go ahead,
Alan. You sound so confident when you talk about the Constitution and what rights are prevailed upon the Americans vis-a-vis the Constitution. But that's not how everyone feels. Now, you are known as an originalist. Tell us why you are an originalist and why you feel that you can interpret the Constitution in its correct meaning, not only for guns, but on First Amendment rights and other rights that are individual in nature.
Well, I don't believe that I'm infallible, and just like anybody else, I'm liable to make mistakes. But I believe that it's important that we ask the right questions when we try to interpret the Constitution. If we're going to get the right answers, it's important to focus on the right questions. And the way we see it, originalists, more or less these days, is as follows. Originalism, as far as I see it, and some of my friends see it, is the doctrine that says that you interpret the words according to their original public meaning. That is, the Constitution has language in it. That language means something. And the meaning it has is the meaning that the people who ratified it thought it had. So you have to go back to the time of the ratification, look at the language, and see what that language meant to the people who ratified it. And then once you understand that, that's the concept that's guaranteed, and you have to apply it to modern-day circumstances. Now, some people get the history wrong. Maybe we have disputes about what the meaning of the language is, but we have to at least start with those questions. What does the language say, and what did it mean to the ratifiers? If it doesn't mean those things, then it's really meaningless. And the Constitution does not say whatever the Second Amendment means, for example. Let's start with that. Though I suppose this also works for the First Amendment or any other part of the Constitution. It does not say judges should uphold whatever gun laws they think are good and strike down whichever gun laws they think are bad. Likewise, judges aren't supposed to simply uphold the good speech laws and get rid of the bad speech laws. No, these are rights. Those rights have a certain meaning. They have a certain scope. We're supposed to discover what that scope is when we're talking about a right, and then apply it towards the situation that's presented in a given case.
Alan, let me ask you this, though. Isn't that a straw man argument, though, because the people who are detractors from the originalists are saying that how can anyone have known what the original intent was when the Constitution was written? So the fact that you say about that, we want to stick to what it said there and make sure of the accuracy. But what about not knowing the intent? And then, of course, the corollary to that is, what about the changing times where there could not even have been any insight into what would happen in the future as far as the Second Amendment and other amendments?
Okay. Originalism, as I argue it, is not a doctrine that has anything to do with original intent. Original intent is the idea that you're supposed to psychoanalyze the framers and figure out what was going on in their heads. I believe that's actually the argument that our opponents were making in the Heller case. They were trying to say, well, yes, there's a right to keep and bear arms, but what they were really thinking was it was a collective right. None of that. I don't believe that we need to try to figure out the psychology of the people who wrote the law. We're just trying to figure out what the language meant at the time. Let's look, for example, at the president. The president is supposed to serve for 4 years. That's what the Constitution says, right? A term is 4 years. Do we say, well, maybe they were thinking about 4 years on Mars, or maybe they were thinking about 4 years on the Mayan calendar? No. 4 years, we look to see what did a year mean to a person in 1789. Well, it meant a year on our calendar, 365 days, the Earth going around the sun. And that's the meaning of the year that we give it, even though, year might mean something else. We don't do that guesswork. We look to see what the concept meant in the ordinary language of the day. It's important to remember the Constitution is something that went out to the public for ratification. It's a document that the people are supposed to understand. It's a document that's supposed to contain sort of a popular conception of what is not to occur.
But of course, that's at the time. And you make some excellent points when you talk about you're not trying to figure out the intent, because how are you going to do that? No one's going to know. Time has passed. But get to the second point, which is what you just talked about now, and that the world we live in now was not anticipated, and maybe the world is Mars versus what it was back when the framers put the Constitution together.
For sure. Well, the framers didn't have the internet. They didn't have broadcasting. They didn't have too many Rastafarians or Mormons walking around. But they understood that a Rastafarian is somebody who would be practicing a religion, same thing with a Mormon. They would understand that broadcasting, if you were to explain what a radio was to the people in the 1790s, oh, that's speech. So, yes, we're supposed to take these old concepts and apply them to the modern day. I mean, wiretapping is another great example. They didn't have telephones. There was no nobody reading your email, right?
They didn't have email.
That's right. But
they had freedom of speech.
But they understood you're supposed to be secure in your person, papers, and effects.
Right.
And so courts could say, look, there was an understanding that there's a certain privacy interest that can't be violated by the police, outside of certain social norms. And we bring that forward and apply it to today's technology. And the same is true of speech, of religion, of guns, of whatever. You obviously are not going to have a document from 1791 that governs anything in the modern world. I mean, right? I mean, you have, the freedom of the press.
That's obvious.
They didn't have modern presses.
That's definitely obvious. So we have to take a quick break, but I want to ask you after the break, we want to talk a little bit about Donald Trump and the presidency and how your theory, which is supported by many, of course, fits into the Trump presidency, and whether there should be some fear that perhaps Donald Trump doesn't understand what the Constitution is there for and how it could impact the country. We'll talk about that after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Mayor Eric Garcetti remembers growing up in L.A.
I'm a fourth-generation Angelino, someone who grew up feeling safe biking on the streets of the San Fernando Valley. Someone who played in Encino Little League. Someone who piled into the Chevy station wagon on the weekends, the kind with the wood paneling on the side, to grab a chili burger at Tommy's with my parents and my sister, and, well, if we behaved, maybe a soft serve from Carvel. It was a simple kind of life, but it was the kind of life that we all dream of.
Mayor Garcetti brings this experience to work every day as mayor.
We created jobs, we raised the minimum wage, and we cut our city's business taxes and passed a tax credit, bringing film jobs back to LA. Together, we've made progress. Together, we can make a lot more.
Eric Garcetti for Mayor on March 7th. Paid for by Garcetti for Mayor 2017. Additional information is available at ethics.lacity.org.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company failed you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
LA, are you ready for another election? Of course you are, and KABC News has got you covered.
On Tuesday, LA voters have some big decisions to make on the mayor and city council.
Marijuana, development, the homeless, and tax hikes.
Count on the KABC News team to keep you informed on the real stories behind the ballot, who's pushing for what, and how much it will cost.
And as the polls close, the KABC News election desk will bring you the latest on what you've decided for the future of our city.
As we cover another election, keep it on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to Gervey's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, we are back, and we are turning Murphy's Law upside down. I'm Alan Gervey, and Carrie Kasem is not with us today. We are talking to Alan Gura, whose legal practice is the Gura PLLC in Alexandria, Virginia, and he's dedicated to Supreme Court appellate and strategic litigation. He argued the Heller and the McDonald cases on guns at the Supreme Court. Alan, before the break, we were talking about the Constitution and the intentions of the framers, as well as what the Constitution actually says and adhering to it. Do you have concerns with this present president, Donald Trump, that the Constitution will not be upheld as you would like to see it?
I have those concerns with every politician. And yes, I have them with Donald Trump. I had them with Barack Obama. I can promise you that I will have them in the future with whoever comes after Trump. Remember, the president plays a particular role in our government. So do members of the Senate and the House and politicians at the state level. And all of these politicians are supposed to be responsive to their constituents, their voters. The one branch of government that is supposed to bring people back into compliance with the Constitution is the judiciary. It's the judges who, at the end of the day, have to decide, because somebody has to decide. Somebody in any system of government, however you organize it, someone's got to decide, be the final say as to whether the rules are being followed. And in our system, that's the third branch of government, the judges, who tell us whether or not something is or is not constitutional. The president takes an oath to uphold the Constitution, but at the end of the day, he's not a constitutional scholar. He has political instincts and interests that he tries to be responsive to, and it takes an independent judiciary to actually engage the Constitution and enforce the law and bring the government into line. That's where I come in. I'm one of the people who try to present those cases to the courts. What we are hoping to see the president do, at least, is appoint people to the bench who are going to engage with the Constitution, people who will try to not defer, not take a back seat, not say, oh, it's too complicated and vague and I don't know and I'll respect the democracy. We need people who are going to go in and do their absolute best to try to understand what the Constitution means and to apply it without excuse, forcefully, to the government when the government steps out of line.
All right, so we're going to talk about Neil Gorsuch in a second. But first, Yale's Dean of Law, Robert Post, wrote that Trump's Twitter delivered insults against a federal judge who stayed his controversial travel ban risk making the president an enemy of the law and the Constitution. A few weeks back, we had Christiane Amanpour on our show, and she talked about Trump being an enemy of the media. Do you see what Robert Post is saying? And I think the Harvard Law Dean also joined in the criticism that Trump is actually an enemy of the law and the Constitution.
Well, those are very tough words. I'm not sure I'd go quite that far. I think there are, in some respects, it's true that every president and every politician who would contravene constitutional limitations is, use that type of language and say, well, he's an enemy of the Constitution. Is Barack Obama an enemy of the Constitution because he did many things that might have exceeded federal authority? Maybe perhaps in some technical semantic sense, you'd say yes. I'm not sure it's the language that I would use. I have many disagreements with Donald Trump about a lot of things. I'm not necessarily thrilled that he's there every single day. There are some things I do like that he's doing, and I'm perfectly happy to give him credit for those. But I would back away from saying that, you know, he's an enemy of the Constitution. I mean, unless he actually purported to do things like, you know, jail judges and justices of the Supreme Court, dissolve Congress, imposed military authority. You know, he hasn't done anything like that.
So that's a good point, Alan, that you bring up, because a lot of times people who are our listeners are involved in political debate on their Facebook posts or on social media, and they don't have the experience or obviously the know-how and knowledge and intellect that you do in these areas. And everyone asks, and we get calls into the show, isn't Donald Trump violating the right of the presidency, first of all, and isn't it in violation of the Constitution? So now we have you here on the line. We're talking to Alan Gura. Tell us if you think there are ways that we can see this violation of the Constitution and of the legal authority of the president.
Well, I believe that there probably are things that Donald Trump has done and will do that you could point to and say that they are in violation of the Constitution. I'm just suggesting that we probably shouldn't use overheated language like that makes him an enemy of the Constitution or somehow un-American. I mean, there's just a role. I mean, one of Donald Trump's greatest flaws, and he has many flaws, but I think one flaw that he has, that most people would agree with me on this, is that he tends to use very irresponsible language. So let's not copy that when we criticize him properly on those things that he's subject to criticism on. I am concerned about some of his proposals with respect perhaps to immigration, not all of them. I think to some degree, you know, he's within his authority. To some degree, perhaps he's not. I, you know, couldn't give you a laundry list of every single thing he's done or will do that is or isn't constitutional, but I would say this. Every president transgresses the Constitution in at least some respect. That's in and of itself not shocking.
Let's talk a little bit about the media for one moment. Do you think if Donald Trump, and I'm a lawyer here just like you are, and I haven't seen all the evidence, I'm not going to pretend to say things I don't know about, and the media should probably take a lesson from that, but do you think by banning certain media organizations that there's a violation of the free speech, communication, First Amendment, media rights?
No. As far as I know, the president has not forbidden CNN from broadcasting. I don't think he's told the Washington Post to shut down their printing operations. He's allowed to take questions from whoever he wants to take a question from. Look, there are a lot of people out there who are poor on the news, and it's maybe a bad idea for the president not to talk to the leading outlets that have the most readers and viewers. Maybe that's bad form, but it doesn't violate anybody's rights. There's no right to talk to the president. I have the right to say what I want about him, but I don't have the right to demand that the pick up the phone and talk to me.
And I'm glad you brought up this point because it's an important one. And some people say, You know, you have to look at the details, you have to look at the evidence. But when we get to the immigration ban, don't you think the argument that you just made in violation of individual rights, free speech, etc., doesn't that also apply to immigration because the devil may be in the details, or we need to look more at what exactly the ban involves versus simply saying that Muslims or certain immigrants are being kept out of this country in violation of our laws?
Yes, I can tell you that the Congress has given the president in our laws a great deal of authority over immigration, and there are going to be questions about it. And I'm not an immigration law expert. I will not give you opinions about immigration law, but I know enough about it to know that there's a great deal of authority that's been delegated to the president in this area. And the question is going to be whether or not he has stepped inside or outside of his bounds in drawing up some of these rules and orders. And that's going to be litigated by people who know a lot more about immigration than I do. We'll let the courts figure that out.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You go ahead.
I was going to say that's the diplomatic answer, and I wish more people would understand this and listen to lawyers more so than politicians and lay people who don't understand exactly what you just said in all of these issues. People jump to conclusions. People, draw their own inferences. But you really, as a lawyer, you really have to see the evidence. You have to understand what's involved in each order or in each particular political move. And if there's a violation, then you're going to court. You're going to go and argue perhaps in front of the Supreme Court in for the Heller case, as you did. And we're going to get, at least from the Supreme Court of the day, we're going to get an opinion, regardless of whether people think that it's very, very political. As Brian Leiter, one of our guests, said that it was just a super political mechanism that had nothing to do with the actual law. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Yeah, and also I think it's important to remember there's a huge difference between whether something is constitutional and whether it's a good idea or not. Sometimes they're the same thing, and sometimes they're not. Justice Scalia had famously a stamp. Eventually somebody made him a stamp that said, stupid but constitutional, right? This thing is dumb, it's a bad idea, but it's constitutional to do it. Conversely, there are a lot of policies that might be great. They might work out fine, but you can't do them because there's something in the Constitution that bars you from doing it. So hopefully our job as Americans is to try to make sure the government does the things that are both good and constitutional, and at least that it doesn't do anything that's unconstitutional. But if something is bad but constitutional, then the answer to that is to replace the lawmakers and to replace the president.
Exactly. That's the cornerstone of a democratic system. Alan, are you up for a little bit of a debate?
Sure.
Oh, good. Because after the break, we're going to bring on Sanford Levinson. Sandy Levinson probably has a little different thought about the Second Amendment, about the Constitution. He did write the article, The Embarrassing Second Amendment. He will be joining Gervie's Law after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on 790 KABC. We'll be right back.
Gary? Why aren't you outside enjoying the party?
Hey, Michelle. It's this heartburn. When it hits, it really hits hard.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's it. I've had it. I'm gonna kick acid with Rolaids.
Rolaids Advanced goes to work instantly for powerful relief of your worst heartburn, bloating, and gas.
Wow, you're packed fast.
Yeah, I feel much better. Now this is a party.
Kick acid and gas with Rolaids Advanced.
Like I just couldn't lose weight.
My digestion was really messed up.
Hi, I'm Dennis Black in Dallas, Texas. Good nutrition is a major factor in good health. But in this day and age, it's hard to eat right. That's why I created Texas Superfood. Texas Superfood is made from 55 raw, vine-ripened fruits and vegetables. In a capsule or a powder, you can see them all at TexasSuperfood.com.
To order, go to TexasSuperfood.com or call us at 877-55-TEXAS. That's 877-55-TEXAS.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW lawyers won't give up when the insurance company failed you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Talk Radio.
790-KABC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervey and Kerry Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Yeah, we're back. I'm Alan Gervey. You're listening to Gervey's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We've been talking to Alan Gura. Of course, Alan Gura, legal practice is called the Gura PLLC. It's in Alexandria, Virginia, and he's dedicated to Supreme Court appellate and strategic litigation. He was the main attorney in the Heller and McDonald decisions, which we've spoken about. Now we are welcoming on the line to talk with us, as Alan remains here, Sanford Levinson. Sanford Levinson received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Law and Court section of the American Political Science Association. He is the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair of the University of Texas Law School. He is an authority in this area, has written an amazing amount of articles, book reviews, commentaries, blogs. He blogs on balkanization. He's written six books. Sandy Levinson, welcome to Gervey's Law.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
That was quite an introduction, wasn't it?
Yep.
Professor Levinson, a quick question for you. We're talking about the Heller case. Now, you have described yourself as a card-carrying ACLU member who doesn't own a gun and who has argued that the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution limits the government's authority to regulate private gun ownership. Was the Heller decision wrong?
No. The decision, I think, was correct. I disagree quite strongly with Justice Scalia's opinion. I think it could have been written in a much more plausible way. But Justice Scalia was imprisoned by his own originalist ideology that required him, I think, basically to make up a history of the Second Amendment that is not faithful to the historical record. But that doesn't mean that an opinion could not have been written coming out exactly the same way. And one can argue, actually, somewhat similarly with regard to McDonald.
Alan Gura, how do you respond to that?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what Professor Levinson's preferred opinion might be. I think Justice Scalia's opinion in Heller was terrific. I think he applied the correct methodology and reached the correct result. And I would also commend Justice Stevens' dissent in Heller. I might add, at least Justice Stevens, although I think he was completely wrong, asked some of the right questions. That is, at least he cared about the historical record. Now, I think that he veered off trying to answer matters of legislative intent, and to the extent that he talked about the history, he didn't quite understand it correctly. But at least both sides in the case were talking about the history and what the framers were attempting to do or had done.
Professor Levinson, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree that both sides were talking about it. The basic problem, as somebody who's taught in law schools now for 35 years, we don't train students to be competent historians, and neither Justice Scalia nor Justice Stevens, whatever one thinks of them, is remotely competent as an historian. Lawyers look to the historical record to argue, to advocate where they want to come out. It would have been very, very easy to come out the very same way and for Mr. Gura to win his case. I admire him for bringing the case.
Thanks.
To argue a living Constitution argument that whatever the Second Amendment means, and my view is that the Second Amendment has far, far more to do with empowering the public ultimately to overthrow an oppressive government than it does to empower an individual to engage in self-defense. By the mid-1850s, there is a consensus ranging from Roger Taney to Charles Sumner that there is an individual right to keep and bear arms for a variety of purposes, one of which is self-defense. But Justice Scalia is addicted, or was addicted, to the notion that we have that we're bound by the meanings of 1787, and he simply wasn't faithful to the best history that's been written about the Second Amendment.
So
one could have decided Heller without ever referring to the Second Amendment, for that matter.
Sandy, let me ask Sandy
about the Ninth Amendment.
Let me ask you this. When we talk about originalism, do you think that in that particular case, in Heller and McDonald, that the court was too stuck on the premise of trying to be originalists when they shouldn't have been, and perhaps there's no room or place for originalism in the Supreme Court decision-making?
Yeah, I don't want to go so far as to say there's no room at all. But going back to Robert Bork, where he said the only legitimate way of interpreting the Constitution is original intent, and at times Scalia was prone to say the same things, that's just foolish for two reasons. One, it doesn't remotely capture the experience that we've had in interpreting the Constitution over what's now 225 years. Secondly, if you do believe that original understandings, original intent, original public meaning, and there are all our various differences and definitions
right.
of originalism, if you do believe in that, then for God's sake, try to hire judges who are trained to do history rather than amateurs.
That makes sense. Alan Gura, does it make sense?
It makes plenty of sense. Look, the framers ratified an amendment that said people have a right, you know, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Well, what does that mean? Well, we look to see what the people thought of the right to keep and bear arms was in 1791. And lo and behold, there was such a right. There was such a right in English law. It was recorded in, for example, the 1689 Declaration of Rights in England. There were courts that had given it application and meaning. There were scholars who had discussed what it meant. And so we knew what this right was. It was something that existed there at the time. So we can look to see what the legal contours and features of that right were to understand what was the people put in document. And it goes back to Blackstone. Blackstone talked about the auxiliary right to arms, which came out of the interest in self-defense. I mean, this wasn't made out of thin air. The people got this language from somewhere.
But are we talking, Alan, are we talking about a militia, or are we talking about individual rights when you go back historically?
We're talking about individual rights. And the militia clause does figure into the story because that tells you, and I think Justice Scalia explained this very well, it tells you why it was that the right to keep and bear arms was codified. It gives you the reason for codifying the right, but it's a pre-existing right. The same phrase, the right of the people, also exists in the First Amendment. It also exists in the Fourth Amendment. People are said to have rights in the Ninth Amendment. The Tenth Amendment talks about the powers retained by the people in the state. So for sure, there is a concept of what the right is. Now, the relationship between the two clauses is that the framers were afraid, not of the Brady Center and gun controllers, but they were afraid of the king preventing people from acting as a militia. That is, the militia had been a very useful institution in the Revolution, or so they thought, and they were afraid that the king would prevent people from acting as militia, and the way that the king would go about doing that would be, as King George had done, by going after the arms that were necessary for service in the militia. The militia system depended entirely on the private ownership of firearms. And so because the private ownership of firearms has this feature to it, which we think is important, we're going to guarantee the right to keep and bear arms.
Let me ask you this.
That right's an individual right.
It's an individual right. Let's talk about that really quickly because we got a lot to cover. Peruta versus San Diego, is that going to get to the Supreme Court?
Your guess is as good as mine. The Supreme Court has appeared to lose interest in the Second Amendment since McDonald. They've had a lot of excellent chances. Some cases presented by me, many presented by other people, some of whom are quite excellent lawyers. The Supreme Court has turned away all those cases for the last 6 or 7 years, largely. So who knows? And of course, it's still a shorthanded court. I think in order to take the case, they would have to at least delay it a little bit to make sure that there's time for Justice Gorsuch to to join Manners, and perhaps they want to.
I do want to talk about Justice Gorsuch in a second, but first let me ask Professor Levinson, what is your opinion on the Peruta case? Should the law have an effect of restricting most people from carrying guns in public?
I think that cities and states across the country can come to their own conclusions on that. Frank Easterbrook, a very, very conservative judge on the Seventh Circuit, wrote a quite remarkable opinion in the run-up to McDonald, in which he said, and I think this is absolutely right, that conservatives are really split. On the one hand, modern conservatives profess to love local autonomy, states, that there shouldn't be one-size-fit-all solutions coming from Washington. On the other hand, with regard to the issue of guns, what at least some conservatives, not all, seem to approve of is a one-size-fits-all policy implemented by the U.S. Supreme Court. So it seems to me that there are some places in the country which can perfectly reasonably decide that open carry makes a lot of sense, or that concealed carry, even on campuses. This is Texas, which I'm not very fond of, but that's the conclusion of the Texas legislature. There are other places, including big cities like Chicago, that are indeed faced with genuine gang and crime problems, that can come to the conclusion that all things considered, open carry really is not a great idea. So it seems to me that unless you really do believe strongly in one-size-fits-all conclusions from 5 out of 9 judges in Washington, you would actually allow quite a bit of slack, even if Alan and I agree that there is some floor beneath which states and localities can't go, that you do have a constitutional right to have a firearm in your home as an implement of self-defense. I think he and I both agree on that. Thereafter, it really does get more complicated,
and it gets more
detailed.
Reasonable
people can disagree.
And, you know, we had Erwin Chemerinsky on the show not too long ago, and Professor Chemerinsky said essentially the same thing. People thought he was debating Michael McConnell, and Michael McConnell said, what planet are you on, Erwin? And Erwin said, hey, I'm not saying that the Second Amendment doesn't give individuals the right to bear arms, to have a gun, but really we have to look at regulation and we have to look at details of types of gun, type of person, and that does become complicated. I want to switch over to Neil Gorsuch. First of all, Alan Gura, and we have to move fairly quickly. What is your opinion? Is Donald Trump going to get who he thinks he's going to get if Gorsuch is confirmed?
As far as I can tell, yes. Neil Gorsuch has a sterling record. He is somebody who is extremely well qualified to be a justice of the Supreme Court. And I would hope that he gets confirmed, and I expect that he will be confirmed.
Weren't you concerned that Donald Trump would not pick someone from the list that he paraded around before he was elected?
Yes, I confess, and I'll be happy to tell you, I thought the list was a gimmick. Donald Trump has had a very, very long record of saying things he doesn't mean. He's filed bankruptcy who knows how many times, you know, multiple wives. I mean, this is not a guy that I would feel comfortable doing business in unless the money were paid up front. Having said that, he was elected. He won. And lo and behold, his first nomination comes from the list. So, you know, I'm happy to be wrong about that. And I would love if I could be proven wrong. More about every criticism I've ever had
Sandy.
Of Donald Trump. I mean, he can prove me wrong all day long. I would be most delighted.
And that's the hallmark of a great American. Get proven wrong by someone you don't like, but be happy that it benefits the country. Sandy, what's your perspective in one minute or less?
Okay. I think we won't know till he gets on the court. I think all conservatives, and for that matter liberals, but I think especially conservatives, are torn on the one hand by a professed regard for judicial restraint and deference to democratic decision-making by Congress, by state legislatures, by city councils, and on the other hand by a strong commitment to property rights or the Second Amendment or whatever. These things are in tension. Justice Scalia broke people's hearts when he upheld federal drug control law in the Reich case a number of years ago. And so you just don't know until the cases are litigated and decided.
Who would you have rather seen, President Obama's nomination or Donald Trump's nomination?
Oh, of course, President Obama.
I thought you might say that. But,
yeah. Right. I mean, there's no argument about that.
I think that's true for a lot of people. Merrick Garland did get the shaft. And you do, Professor Levinson, think that Neil Gorsuch will be confirmed, correct?
No. I think that it all depends on whether the Republicans are going to break the filibuster. Because I do think that the Democratic base views this as a stolen seat. And I think that there will be 41 Democrats who are prepared to keep the debate going. Now, there are a lot of people who say, well, if that occurs, then Mitch McConnell will break the filibuster and he will be confirmed. But I think that in politics, as we've learned over the last couple of years, we're always subject to being surprised.
I think that's particularly true this year. Last subject, anti-Semitism. Professor Levinson, quickly share with us your experience with the letter that you received in November.
Well, it was a postcard mailed, it appears, from Great Britain that was vilely anti-Semitic. It got a lot of publicity, frankly, I think, because I was teaching at Harvard in the fall. I think if I had received it at UT, it would not have gotten the same publicity. It was awful. A lot of people rallied round. It was a one-off. I didn't change the way I lived. It's just regrettable. The people, I think, who are entitled these days really to be living in fear are undocumented aliens and Muslims, even if they're citizens.
Now,
I didn't really feel fearful by receiving this vile postcard.
Didn't you say that? I think the best response is to say it's really terrible that there are people like this in the world, but then to go on with your life. So if that's true, let me just finish. If that's true, is that what people should do about Donald Trump? Just say it's terrible that people are like this in the world, but then go on with our life.
No, because he's president of the United States, whereas the person who sent me the postcard is not.
It's some schmuck in England.
Exactly.
Alan, we got to close out. What's your perspective on this anti-Semitism wave of vandalism and threats that we're seeing in this country? Is there anything from a legal perspective, constitutional perspective, that can quash this before it gets worse?
Well, I sure hope that the government quashes it. I hope that these people are apprehended and serve very lengthy jail sentences. It's unacceptable and completely outrageous that this stuff is going on. From a constitutional perspective, I would say, look, this is why we have the Second Amendment. I can't stress this enough. The Second Amendment guarantees the right to keep and bear arms. That's always been understood since the beginning of time, going back to before the Revolution, as giving you the means of accessing self-defense, because you can't rely on the government insuring you and following you around everywhere and giving you personal protection. Yes, the government is there to try to catch these disgusting people and put them away, but we all know the crime happens. Even, forget about anti-Semitism, racism. There's just plain crime out there.
Right, hate crime.
And people have the right to defend themselves, and they have a constitutional guarantee that lets them. And I disagree with Professor Levinson. People can bear arms as well.
Sandy,
so they can defend themselves.
You're going to get the last word, and it's only going to be a few words. How do you respond to that in one sentence?
In one sentence, I would say that if it gets to the stage of having to rely on individualized shootouts, then life in the United States will be even scarier than
it is right now. Very good. Alan Gura, Sanford Levinson, we really appreciate you coming on Gervie's Law. Very, very smart, intelligent, diplomatic comments that we appreciate. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. We have to take a quick break, and we'll be back right after this.
If you are behind on your bills, then this message is for you. How would you like to have a large portion of your credit card debt or medical bills forgiven? National Credit Card Relief would like to give you free information on a proven debt forgiveness program. It's not bankruptcy. It's not consolidation. This special program actually wipes clean the portion of your debt that is forgiven. Call for your free forgiveness information now.
800-291-6670. That's 800-291-6670. Don't wait. Call 800-291-6670. Not available in North Dakota.
Tomorrow on NBC, from the creator of Law & Order, the next amazing drama in the city of heroes, Chicago Justice. In a city where justice is sometimes hard to find.
What's happening on the south side of the city is a public emergency.
One team fights for the truth.
Help us get justice.
You are nothing if not persistent.
Philip Winchester and Carl Weathers star in Chicago Justice, premiering tomorrow after Little Big Shots on NBC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, you are listening to Gervie's Law. I'm Alan Gervie, and we had a great show today. Alan Gura and Sanford Levinson talking about the Constitution and a lot about the Second Amendment. And right now, I want to welcome one of my good friends, one of my best friends, actually, the producer of The Usual Suspects, producer of The Way of the Gun, a very strong gun advocate, Ken Kokin.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you so much.
It's great to have you back, Ken. Tell me your thoughts on what we talked about today.
First of all, it's a little intimidating following the three great minds.
Two great minds. I'm just here to orchestrate.
But for me, it comes down to something simple.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a boy growing up in Mar Vista, California, I lived on a cul-de-sac with three Holocaust survivors.
Yeah.
One of them was a guy named Sam Skur, who was in Auschwitz. He knew, and I knew at a young age what the Nazis did. And I remember standing there on my driveway when he said to me and my father, the only way a Jew can protect himself is with a gun in the hand.
Really? That's the way of the gun.
That's not the way of the gun. But today, you know, I'm like, we live in a government that just forced me to buy health insurance with pap smears and transgender surgery as one of the options.
What does that have to do with guns?
It's government tyranny, and they're going to force me at gunpoint. If I don't pay for that insurance plan, they haul me off to jail.
They do?
Yes.
I haven't seen that
happen.
Well,
if you don't pay the fine, and then you're...
And so you think that you can take a gun and start the Wild West?
I'm just saying it's a frog in boiling water. So here's the thing, Alan. You know, the Second Amendment is about guns. It's not necessarily about guns. It's about arms.
Right.
And the arms of the time. So when the government comes after me and says, hey, you can't buy this gun, who are they to say that? It doesn't
Well,
say-
you may have mental problems. You may be a felon.
Let's assume that we don't.
I have no problem with you having the gun. Ken Kokin, take your gun. I trust you. I know you've been to the shooting range. You know what you're doing. I have a problem with people who are not as sane as you and people who don't know how to handle a gun whipping it around.
And how do you feel about millennials texting and driving? You know, where does your safety for our community end? Think about this, Alan. It's not the guns that cause the murders. It's the murderers. And they'll do it with a knife. And they'll do it with a baseball bat. And they'll do it with a car. And they'll do it with a chainsaw. And they'll do it with a pressure cooker. And they'll do it with a fertilizer bomb.
Why should we encourage them by giving them the opportunity to have these really awful assault weapons?
Okay, Alan. So, another Alan. We had Alan Gerver.
Yes,
we had Alan Gervey. We had, now I'm bringing up Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz,
who's been on this show many times.
Alan Dershowitz asked the question, do you want to live in a society where everyone owns guns? And my answer is yes. I have less issues with everyone owning a gun than every millennial owning a car and driving and texting and drinking and doing drugs. I imagine a world where rape, murder, robbery are rare. And so are school shootings, because criminals would assume that everyone has a gun. Most of the time, the gun is used to prevent crime. It's not even fired. And a gun is used as a deterrent. And a population that's an armed population is one that you will never have a Holocaust.
Never another Holocaust. Those are sweet words, Ken Kokin. I don't agree with you with the guns, but I agree with the sentiment. You've been listening to Gervie's Law. I'm Alan Gervie. Thanks, Ken, for being with us. And